From UCB Comedy Studios, this is the UCB Digital Podcast. I'm Nate Russell. Hey, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the show. Welcome back. If you're tuning in for the first time, welcome to you. Always lovely to have new folks aboard this show. This is a show about peeling back the curtain and talking to comedians and filmmakers about their craft, and today is no exception to that. We have somebody with a lot of insight on a couple of different sides of the industry. In the studio talking to us today, our good friend Lisa Kleinman, who UCB folks know from her days and still is an actor on Maude Night. She's been on videos across the internets and on TV, and she's an actress who's all over the stage here at UCB, and she also has a second life, another life. What do they call those things? A day job that she's also passionate about as a development executive at North South Productions. So we'll dig into that and have a great conversation with her about how those two sides of Lisa inform the whole. And how they sort of pull and push against each other and how she makes it all work. So really excited for that conversation and hope you are too. Ben Hosley's here. Hey, Ben.
Hey, Nate.
Before we get into that interview, Ben and I just discovered a new term, and it's called time shifting. I wasn't aware of this term, Ben. Were you?
No, I've never heard of this.
So basically the idea here is that time shifting is something that broadcasters are starting to refer to because they're seeing that not only do they need to measure ratings in terms of what viewership is happening on their broadcast channels, but that those numbers look a little bit better if you include people DVRing it and watching it later, people watching on VOD, people watching through different sort of services. Let's push those numbers up a little bit, right? Right, Ben?
Oh, for sure. Yeah, I mean, I don't know why they haven't been paying more attention.
Yeah, but it's definitely a symbol of the disruption happening with these digital mediums. And the reason why this term came across our lives here is Ben and I were just talking about some industry stuff that had been going on. And one of the notes that I just saw come across on Deadline, and I'll send a tweet out about a link to this episode as well, is that IFC is now stating in a way that's bragging, which this article is saying that it used to be that broadcasters didn't brag about time-shifted ratings, but now that this digital medium is becoming so prevalent, they are proud of the fact that Brockmire, their hit comedy that is produced by Funny or Die and is about to hit their season finale, is the most time-shifted new comedy on cable. Which is awesome. I have not seen the show. Ben, have you seen the show?
No, I haven't either.
I
want
to check it out. I've seen the short that it was based on. I mean, this is even a show that has a genesis in the digital medium. The short that this originally came out of was a part of a Funny or Die sports series from like 4 years ago, and it was like a one-off. And it was part of that, like, you know, and Funny or Die still does it where they have celebrities come in and guest star in a video, right? Mm-hmm. And Hank Azaria was the star of that show, of that one episode in a larger series. And I think that some time went on. It was a really great short. And then suddenly they've sort of redeveloped it at IFC as a pilot and then as a series. So it's definitely a really unique sort of development process and a very cool sort of like example of like doing a little bit of work now and seeing the dividends of it grow in the future, which is rad. But now they're sort of being heralded as a hit show, not just because – and what it's saying here is that they get 500,000 live – plus 3 day viewers. I don't know exactly what that term means. I think that means like live viewers over a 3 day period, but that they have a total of 9 million views every week for this show. So that's pretty significant difference, Ben, too, between the broadcast viewers and the sort of viewers across all those platforms.
It makes a huge difference. I mean, I wonder, it's interesting to think of how that works then with advertising deals.
Sure.
Because I'm sure it's going to be very different what you're playing between the show on broadcast versus digital.
Mm-hmm.
But again, that's huge numbers.
Yeah. And I think it changes the way that you think about as a network and as a production company, what kind of projects to take on.
Right.
Because you're thinking about it across these different mediums and trying to figure out what is going to work in all these different spaces to add up to a cumulative number that makes everybody happy and that probably makes everybody's money back, right?
Right.
Which actually leads nicely into our conversation with Lisa as somebody on a development side. So again, Lisa Kleinman, thanks so much for sitting down and talking to us. Excited to have this conversation out there for y'all. As we mentioned before, Lisa is an actor. And that's how I knew Lisa first was as an actor. And then I sort of discovered, oh, you've got this other really important job She is the senior director of comedy development at North South Productions, which, if you don't know North South by name, you definitely know their work. They are the production company behind Impractical Jokers. You heard of that one, Ben? You heard of that show? Little show, Impractical Jokers? Pretty much is one of the most popular comedy shows in the world. Yeah, that one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I have.
So she's the senior director of comedy development in North South, based here in New York. And North South has offices all over the country and does work all around the world. And then she's balancing that career path, of which she has a lot of success, with her acting and her acting career and her comedy career. And so really interesting conversation to have as somebody who has insight for creators working with development executives and for people working in development in how to work with creatives. She sees it from both angles. How does she navigate that process with people who are her colleagues in different aspects of her career? And how does it all sort of come together, and where is it all going, and what the fuck is it all about? So we answer all those questions in this interview. And we did so while we also sipped the Bronx beer. We had a Bronx American Pale Ale while we had this one. The American Pale Ale, one of the higher alcohol volume ones, Ben, but mm-hmm. also a very tasty beer. I'm reading on their website that it's English caramel and biscuit malts balanced with West Coast citrus hops. Again, I didn't taste the biscuit the last time I drank it, but I'm gonna look for biscuit the next time I have one.
It's in there.
It's in there. Pick one of those up the next time you're down at the UCB East Bar or anywhere around New York City, because they're all over the place. And go to thebronxbrewery.com for information on all of their craft beers. The Bronx Brewery, of course, the official house beer of the UCB Comedy Podcast Network. All right, let's jump into it. Our conversation with actor, development executive, and all-around wonderful person, Lisa Kleinman. Well, Lisa, thanks for doing this.
Thank you so much for having me.
I was excited to chat because you're not the first development executive who I've talked to on this show.
All right,
sorry.
I'm out of here.
But you're the first development executive who I know as an actor first.
Cool. Well, I'm glad you think that because I feel like that line is slowly getting blurred. What other development execs have been in here?
We've done panels with development.
Oh, okay.
So like, you know, Kelsey Balance at CISO? We did a show with her last summer, and some development folks from like True TV. Christine, you know
Christine Walters. Yeah,
who's another person who I know as a filmmaker foremost before a development person.
Yeah, and Christine and I worked together on that set. She was my development executive when I did a pilot with True.
Oh, really?
It was amazing.
That's so funny.
Yeah, it was like really cool and full circle.
It's a closed loop.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, let's talk about how that closed loop works for you and how it maybe, you know, doesn't, or, you know, or where it conflicts, I guess. So your sort of like background, first and foremost, was as an actor, right? You have an actor training and background. I saw the London Academy of Music and Dramatic Arts on your resume.
Classically trained actor, that's right. I know Restoration Dance, which comes in handy all the time, let me tell you. Uh-huh. And in London, they were like, you gotta know Restoration Dance. I can't name one play that includes that.
Uh-huh.
And that includes like Restoration plays. Armed combat, unarmed combat,
wow.
Shakespeare, Shepard, Shaw, you know, all the classics.
All the things you need in a pitch meeting about reality TV shows, right?
Okay, yeah, it comes up when I'm like, it's very Chekhovian, yeah. You know, it really brings
they
the house
it.
Down.
They get it.
I wanted to be an actor, and I went to an acting conservatory that was at one point very highly rated that I think has since slipped down the ladder a little bit and has not made any lists. I was very list conscious when I applied there. I was like, I need to be on this list.
On the list.
Yeah, I need to be on some sort of list.
And so how did you then, when you sort of got started, you were on a track for acting,
mm-hmm.
and you were working during, like, how did you sort of wind up where you are right now?
Well, I'm obsessed with money.
Okay.
I've always been like very, how am I going to make money? And I think before I even decided to go to acting school, I started waiting tables because I was like, oh, well, that's what you do as an actor. Like, kind of like in the old school thing. So I started waiting tables and that was like my income for a really long time while I was in school and then out of school auditioning and waiting tables and cocktailing and bartending at night.
Okay.
And then I was like, acting sucks. I auditioned for Doubt, the play, like 50 times, I feel. And it just got to this point where I was like, I am not going to book this. It's really like out of my emotional range.
Uh-huh.
it's very serious.
Theater acting.
Yeah, I was doing a lot of like regional theater auditions. And yeah, I just decided I didn't want to do doubt in like Portland, Maine, or in like,
sure,
you know, Portland, Oregon, any of the Portlands.
You know. Any port, not going there.
Not going.
Okay. So then that's how you sort of got onto the production or development side, or what would you sort of track in on that
side?
Well,
that's how I started getting into comedy.
Okay.
Is I was like, I can't like fake cry, like, mm-hmm. you know, like be like a little nun. So I started doing improv and taking classes. And I was in LA for a little bit after graduation, and I mm-hmm. did Iowa West out there.
Okay.
And then when I came to New York, I started at UCB and was just like waiting tables. And then comedy is like a really nocturnal activity.
Sure.
So when you're making money at night, you need to then like kind of change things up, because like if you're doing shows at night, you're not waiting tables or making money. So I got a day job working at a law firm.
Okay.
And that was like a huge step in like my adult development, which was like, oh, I'm going to like get health insurance, get like a real paycheck, mm-hmm. and be able to perform more.
You're just going to be exhausted all the time.
Yeah, which is like the best, you know?
Mm-hmm. What year is this about?
This is like, oh my God, it was on my time hop today.
Oh, really?
Yeah, it was in 2011.
Okay.
It was like, I just got a new job, things are changing, okay. good changes, but a feelings. It was like a very earnest post. It's like horrifying to see that. So that was like in 2011, and yeah. I graduated in 06.
Okay.
So it was like a while of doing that, and then... And then it got to be that grind of like, you know, wearing, you know, business casual clothes, waking up very early,
yeah,
being so tired from like late night texts and drinking and going out, sure. that I basically was at this point where I was like, I just need a job in comedy. I want to get paid to be in comedy.
Okay.
So I kind of this like opportunity, a friend couldn't do a job for an MTV pilot that was like a storytelling pilot.
Okay.
It was like the concept was like he said, she said. So it was like recreating different points of view, very heteronormative points of view of like dates.
Okay.
And then I was running a storytelling show and kind of just like lied my way through the interview and was able to get a job as like writer producer on this pilot. When sometimes this is like, I feel like when you get a call for an interview, they've called almost no one else. Like, I've been in a lot of lucky positions where I'm like, I know I'm not qualified for this job, but I also know you don't have any other choice.
Okay.
So I'm just going to, like, you know, power through. Because if you're talking to me, you haven't talked to anyone else.
Okay. Okay.
And that's definitely how I got that job.
And that was as a writer-producer for an MTV pilot.
Exactly. And that was so hard and so scary. And I was like, did like medium good at it, but like good enough to like not get fired and like get through.
Mm-hmm. And that led to?
So that led to my first like ability to like have like a credit, work with a production company,
okay.
work with producers, be in network meeting, like kind of just like see how it all works.
Sure.
And it was a really small team, so I was doing, like, a lot of, like, producing work for it, a lot of writing, casting, you know. It was, like, a real, like, you know, full-service job that I was, you know, doing a lot.
And none of that stuff is stuff that's in your background.
No, I didn't know how to do any of it. But it's, like, it's not that hard. You got to fake it till you make it.
Sure.
Like, you can Google most things or talk to your friends. I remember I wrote my scripts in Celtics.
Okay.
Because, like, that's what people do because it's free. And they were like, I don't know what that is. And I was like, it's like Final Draft, but it's not.
But it's free.
But it's free. And they were like, oh, they were so, like, upset with me.
Because
it's like when I didn't know how to download. I didn't know how to do anything. And I was, like, trying not to let that show.
Sure.
And they were like, next time. We are never using this format again. I was like, cool.
Yeah.
If there is a next time.
I think there's a new tool that lets you translate it. Like, there's a way to do it now. There's like something's come in the middle that's like, do you use Celtics, but you're embarrassed of it?
Yeah. There's like a...
Here's this bridge that gets you to Final Draft format.
Oh, I would have killed for that.
That's why they've got it. I'm sure it's on the App Store.
Oh, I've since like convinced my job to get me Final Draft.
Yeah.
So I've graduated, but you know, who cares? Everyone uses Celtics.
Sure.
They were so elitist.
And it's actually gotten a lot better. There's sort of like studio features with all the pre-pro stuff you can do. It's kind of neat.
Yeah.
It's a neat tool.
Yeah, you shouldn't be classist about it. No, yeah, yeah.
Not above it at all. So wait, let me just understand the timeline then. So it's like you're like 2006, you're graduating, you bounce around a little bit because you're in Boston for school, right?
I was in Boston for school.
You go to L.A., you come back to New York. Yeah. You're sort of like doing an acting thing and a theater thing. You say, fuck that.
Yeah.
Let me get a job.
Yeah.
That's 2011.
That's 2011.
And then you say, fuck that. Let me get back into production.
Yeah, well, this opportunity just came to me because I was like at a very low point. Yeah. I was like super depressed. I like asked the job. I was like, is there any way? Because I was a receptionist where you're glued to a desk. I was like, is there any way I can like go out for audition? So they made this position for me, which was basically a janitor position. So I would just clean up just trash, like catering trash.
Yeah.
And it was like, great, I'll do anything just to like get my career started in some way.
Yeah.
And then I just faked my way into this like writer producer job for a pilot because they were wildly unprepared for getting picked up for a pilot. And I was, you know, just like gonna do it.
And so then you start acting. So your greatest role then is as a producer. You're acting like a producer.
Yeah, I'm acting like a producer. And that was cool because it's like a cool thing to be able to tell people that you're working on a show.
Sure.
Instead of being like, I'm basically a glorified custodian at a law firm.
Mm-hmm.
And like, I, you know, do like videos, like College Humor was like big and like above average. Like I was doing like, you know, comedy work that was like, at the most, going to pay me like $3,000 for like an amazing, and that was amazing.
Sure.
You know, like a lot of that kind of like comedy non-union video stuff, but that was not going to help me quit my job.
So that's a simultaneous track of like the comedy stuff that's going on.
Exactly.
Okay, that all makes sense.
Yeah.
And so how does it sort of dovetail into a job in development?
So that credit of working on that MTV show led me to another job because like there was a line producer overlap and they were looking for a writer producer for a fashion show on E, a talking panel show.
Cool.
And I was just like, I just got in at the right time. Again, I knew they started on Monday. I was interviewing on Friday. They didn't have a lot of options. Uh-huh. And I charmed my way, I guess, into like just them feeling confident enough to hire me. And that was a season. So that was 8 episodes of this fashion talk show starring Kristen Cavallari of The Hills.
Sure.
And this other woman named Orly Shani, who was like on a reality show about fashion. And they made up a title for my job was editorial producer because I just wrote all the episodes. Mm-hmm. Like I wrote the prompter scripts. I worked with the comedian, I worked with the celebrities to like make them funnier. And that was great. So I did that for 8 episodes, and I thought I was going to get picked up, so I quit my job. And I was so excited, and I felt really great about it. But E! Did not, in fact, pick up that show that no one's ever heard of.
Uh-huh.
But the production company I got really close with, and they wanted me to redevelop it more as a comedy to try to resell it to the network.
Okay.
So because I was so close to the show, they were like, well, let's try to rework it. What are your suggestions? How can we format it differently? Who would be better hosts, you know, to make it a more comedy-forward show?
Sure.
And that opportunity kind of then they just started letting me, you know, help story produce, you know, kind of branded content or just, you know, if they were working on a new pitch or like a deck, I would just write decks for them.
Hmm.
So I just I got to be pretty okay at writing, kind of like it's not like good writing, like copy editing.
Sure.
Or like I feel like I could work for like an advertising firm.
Okay.
You know, like buzzy, like kind of like treatment writing.
Yeah, the sort of like stuff that's like the 10,000-foot view of the idea. You know, pitch deck stuff.
Exactly. Yeah. It's like this meets this, but supercharged, you know, like bite-sized content, like easily lifted for digital. All of that, like fucking bullshit. But I got kind of okay at it. And then my husband, Casey Jost, for all you inside people, you know him, he works for a show called Impractical Jokers.
Okay.
And that's on True TV. And the production company that makes that show is called North South Productions. And the guy who owns it, you know, is a really nice guy who would go to comedy shows. And I would see him at, you know, weddings of the Jokers because we're also like friends with the guys on the show. And he was always really interested in what I was doing. And I had things to tell him I was doing. I was like, oh, I'm working on this MTV pilot or I'm working on this E! Series. And then he, on a whim, because I think if you're rich, you can have like whims and pursue them. He was on a whim.
Okay.
And he was like, I want to start a comedy division at my production company, but I don't want to like go the whole enchilada. I want to like ease into it. Yeah. And again, I mean, this is like a real recurring theme. I remember in my interview, he's like, I'm talking to a lot of producers. I followed up. There was not one other producer. And he asked me if I would be interested, knowing that I'm a performer, to kind of start this part time for him. And then I started working there 3 days a week.
Yeah.
And then I got a bunch of things going pretty quickly. I got two pilots kind of in the works, which was great. And they were all comedy forward. And then I kind of just, you know, was that only person in the department for a long time.
And you sort of like eased into the job, it sounds like, where it's like, yeah, we're going to start this thing. And you're sort of like seeing what it can be. And then it's part time and then it's more and then it's...
Yeah.
It starts to go.
Yeah. And then when it got busy, I had to go full time. Yeah. And that was hard.
It's interesting. Like, one thing I want to press you on. So you're saying it's a whim to go on this thing, but they also had a wildly successful comedy format show.
Yeah.
So there's something that it's based on more
100%.
Than just like, I woke up today and said, let's do some comedy at this company.
He took off his sleeping cap and he was like, I like comedy.
Yeah. He's got like one of the most popular, right?
It's pretty big. At the time, not as big as it was now, but epically large. Like, it's, I mean, you know, no offense to True TV, but it is their network. It started an entire rebranding of a network, which is so cool. But it's like,
I think
they
would agree with that.
But also, what does that mean? Like, a comedy division? Like, what am I supposed to be doing? And I had no clue. At one point, he was like, are you good at formats?
Yeah.
And I didn't know that format was like a development term, like for what shows are based on, like an act structure. Uh-huh. And I just go, I'm like a storyteller. I like tell stories. And he was like, okay. I was very green. Even though I was like writing these treatments, I didn't know like the terminology of things.
Yeah.
So I just kind of like, you know.
Fake it till you make it.
Yeah. And the first thing I sold was like a character I did for a thing that I was cast in for Reddit that was like this really cool concept. And I worked with the producer that kind of like cast me in that. And we kind of created a show that was like an ensemble-based character show. And we like almost very quickly, it took a very long time to actually film it because development is like the slowest process of all time. But that was like a thing I did for my outside life. I brought into development and was able to do a pilot that I was in.
Cool.
So like that, so it is tricky, but like if you are sneaky enough, you can figure out how to like,
sure,
how to make your dreams come true until it doesn't get picked up and then you don't do anything ever again.
Yeah. In terms of like, I guess the way the question I have is about like, where does the acting, so you've already described a little bit of how they sort of like have the ability to cross over, but let's just walk through the acting track then.
Yeah.
How does some of the stuff that you were sort of pursuing or passionate about line up with this other sort of like career, you know, fake it till you make it side of what you're doing? Because you have the background in acting.
Mm-hmm.
You haven't stopped doing it.
Mm-mm.
In fact, you're probably more busy with it. Then is it something that you get more and more busy with?
Yeah.
I feel like I see you in a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
On that side of things, too.
Yeah,
more
on the internet.
More. On the internet.
On the internet, which is a huge place.
I've heard that.
It's vast. most of it, I feel like I live two different lives, which is a little bit awkward sometimes in my like kind of day job because I will be in pitch meetings. Like when you mentioned Kelsey from CISO, I was like, why do I know that name? It's like, oh, I've pitched her before.
Yeah.
You know, so.
But as actor, Lisa.
No, as development, Lisa.
Okay.
You know, but then I'm sure she's seen like me and other things and it's a weird thing.
Yeah.
And I try to like call it out and, or not. I just try to be like really honest and open and, and like good to the project and not do anything that's like also me, you know. I'm pretty conservative when it comes to like pushing myself for anything. But I would go to work. I'll leave work to go to an audition and I'll come back, or I've left work to shoot things and come back with like a full face of like makeup and hair and then just been like, all right, like what's this meeting?
Yeah.
So it's a very dual kind of life.
And it sounds like, though, that in this particular company and the way it came together, there's the ability for it to be somewhat like to be malleable to that need.
Yeah, I'm very like, I was very honest with like my credentials in the job and also like what I wanted to do. And that was something that luckily I found a place that was like cool with me having another interest and supportive of that, you know.
But it's probably even different than if you'd gone to a place, because it also sounds like you have a relationship there that sort of predates the job in a way that's helpful in that ability to be honest. If you go up to a job and say, just so you know, I've got some other things going on too. Mm-hmm. We don't know each other at all. That's probably a harder conversation than like, we were at this wedding, you know, we have a relationship.
Yeah.
And now that this thing that you have a whim to start.
Yes.
I can be like, well, yes, yes, but.
Exactly. Yeah. And I think that's like, that's really kind of good in the, you know, kind of like advice or, you know, something to think about in the community is, you know, so many people and so many different jobs, and the more people you meet, the more it can kind of come up in organic ways in the future, and they'll appreciate the stuff you've been doing, and you're always doing something. Like, everyone here is working so hard, and they have so much to show for it. So when it does come your way, you can kind of twist a podcast or a live show into, you know, something on the resume that would help you book something.
Cool. On a development side, so because I'm curious how they sort of inform each other. In terms of process, so for development, Lisa, I'm sorry if you don't actually think about yourself in these two different tracks.
No, it, I mean, unfortunately, it's true. I mean, now it's hard.
Yeah.
Yeah, but yeah.
But if we sort of think about about that side, I guess like because you're also working in comedy, right? I guess, like, what do you feel like the actor side of you informs about a development process that helps, you know what I mean, that helps you?
Huh.
But that gives you an edge. Because it's not...
Oh, I think the main thing that gives me an edge is honestly just knowing people.
Yeah.
I've never been in a meeting where someone's named a comedian's name and I've, like, not really known who they are. I think that... like having that wealth of knowledge and of people to call upon. Like, I've had to bring in directors for projects and it's just people I've worked with before. Like, my, like, you know, like Rolodex of friends and people I admire and contacts are so helpful in my development job.
Yeah.
Just because, like, I've been in the scene for so long that, like, I'm at the level that I think executives at networks are, or more so because I just know what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
Like, they're not like, oh, you know this show? And I'm never like, no.
Right.
You know, and I think that's really, really helpful. But more so, like, the development side really informs my comedy.
Okay.
Because, like, in development, you see things through. You see pitches that don't, like, land. You see, like, what things are like in an edit. Like, what sticks and, like, what doesn't. Like, what people respond to and what they don't respond to. I think it helps, like, almost the other way too a lot.
So then let me ask that. What do you wish that more creatives who don't have that duality knew about the process that would help them be more, you know, more successful with it, or more focused in terms of, like, getting something out of the development process that felt like it was viable?
I think the big thing I get a lot of pitches from people of things that I think they think will sell, or things that they think people want to hear that are either derivative of other shows or seem to speak to something. And I think the one thing that I try to do as a development person is something that's, like, really specific and authentic to the person. So I get a lot of, like, you know, I'm traveling the country doing these things. And, like, I mean, that's the biggest thing you get pitched is, like, travel shows, because it's like comedians travel. It gives a new environment. It gives instant conflict. It's fish out of water. But, like, that's a million. And if it doesn't really speak to something that you really care about or you really do, it's just going to get, like, lost in the shuffle.
Yeah, that makes sense. I think sometimes people get lost in terms of, and this is also just, like, maybe a hard reality of development. I think sometimes people feel an inclination to pitch things that are derivative because they themselves do not have the visibility to get something going. Like, there's also the question of, like, if it's unique to you, who the fuck are you?
I know.
And that's a hurdle that, like, and this is just, like, in my brain, like, I think people pitch, well, it's like this, so that there's at least a reference point of something that they're like, and I could do it.
Yeah, I'm not against a reference point.
Yeah.
I think that helps because it gives you, like, tone and where it would live, like, on a network.
Yeah.
But I think famous people can pitch derivative things because they're the special thing about it.
That's true.
But unknown people can only pitch things that are specific to them because that will distinguish them from famous people. Mm-hmm. Like Kevin Hart can do anything. Sure. It's like he has a travel show on Comedy Central. He's doing a workout show for his own network. He's fucking Kevin Hart. He is the biggest thing. Like he can do anything.
Right. You could literally.
You could do dirty jobs with Kevin Hart. You could do unwrap, like whatever stupid
whatever
format
he wants to do.
Any network would be like, yes, please. But if you're saying that, there's like, well, who the fuck are you?
Yeah.
But if you're like, I am a fly fisherman. I'm like the funniest fly fisherman. And I want to write this like unique story that only if I told or like. And then you also like, you know, because everyone here is so scrappy because they have to be, you know, it's like also I shot this web series that like is a little bit of like an incubation of an idea. Like, I mean, obviously everyone would look to Broad City for that, you know, like complete unknowns that had a huge body of work that could speak to what a show would be.
Yeah.
So I think the more unknown you are, the more specific you have to be.
You have to be.
Yeah.
And then in terms of like when you're sort of bringing a project into the to a place like North South that does have like you guys are a pretty big company, right?
Yeah. I think at one point we said we were like the largest independent production company in the world.
In
I don't
the world.
Know. But I also
in
don't
the known
know what
universe.
I also don't know what independent. I know there was like a lot of asterisks. Like there's a lot of things. But yeah, it's a big it's also part owned by Hearst.
Yeah.
Which is like huge.
That's pretty new though, right?
It's ever since I've been there.
Oh really?
Yeah.
So, okay.
I think it's probably a Joker's thing. They like
okay.
We have two hit shows. Say Yes to the Dress, Atlanta.
Sure.
And Impractical Jokers. Both unscripted shows in very different spaces.
Okay. I guess, so, but I mean, it is a pretty big company. When you're looking to sort of bring projects in that do have people who don't have the and with Kevin Hart factor.
Yeah.
I guess what is your like what maybe speak to like the ways that you on a development side work with creatives that that do bring out the best. Like I guess what's your process for like looking for those kind of projects or the right kind of people to bring into projects that you've got going?
Yeah, I think it's if it's a really amazing idea that's like so fresh and so interesting. Like we're working on something with a comedian about like it's a kind of has like a science angle of like why the fuck are we here and how impossible the world is. Like that's an idea we would develop with that person and then maybe they wouldn't be in it. You know, like maybe it wouldn't be something. Maybe they're a creator. We did this with a kind of game show concept, really funny stand up, kind of crafted this game show format. But it's like, who can we cast to be in it?
Sure.
But then also, like, I worked with Mike Kelton at North South, who's an amazing kind of force to be reckoned with at UCB and beyond. And he was just like, I feel like I'm testing for all these shows and getting really close to things and not getting them. And also these shows don't even get made. So I want to make my show. And I immediately just like was like, he's so electric. He's so charismatic. And he was also a really good collaborator. So we were just kicked around ideas. I was able to bring it to North South. And then we did a digital series for MTV to incubate it. And then we did a pilot. The pilot was eventually passed on, but now he's like a regular on MTV. Like, and I don't want to, and it's, I mean, it's because of that, you know, like now he does all this Facebook Live stuff and he's like really in that kind of world. And the pilot didn't work out, which was a bummer, but it really led to his development, you know, in terms of like his exposure to that network.
Because it's interesting too, because you're also coming at it from a development at a production company side of things, which is different than the way that somebody who's a development person at a platform or a network needs to think about it.
Yeah,
you're sort of looking at it because you're not saying like maybe you have good relationships at a particular place. Like I'm sure you guys have a good relationship with True institutionally.
Yeah,
but that's not the only potential platform or buyer that you're going out to. So you're sort of like informing your process on a different set of criteria. Right?
Yeah. I mean, personally, this is like a side note. I don't think I would be able to work at a network. And that I think that would be a conflict of interests.
As someone who's also pursuing an acting track.
I think so.
I mean, that makes sense.
Yeah.
That definitely makes sense.
Because you're kind of representing a brand at that point. And it just gets a little messier. Like if I worked at True, I don't know how cool it would be. You know? And it's happened before with like Jessie Klein at Comedy Central, you know, like she's someone I really look up to as a comedian. She started off in development and then really kind of paved her own way. But But like it's much rarer and harder on the network side. But on the production company side, you want to pitch to like at least six networks. Like every show, you don't want to be like, oh, it's only for True.
Yeah.
Because then all your eggs are in that basket and they could already be working on a show that's exactly like this. I mean, it just it's too narrow.
It's not good for your company.
No. Yeah, like when Mike came in, we wanted to pitch, like we pitched everyone. We pitched Fuse, MTV, Comedy Central, like VH1, like every possible thing.
Mm-hmm.
So I think like six is like a very good, healthy number of networks that you want to like feel that your project could live at.
Yeah, that makes sense. In terms of like your sort of like growth from the moment where you sort of have this conversation about coming into a comedy division, starting a comedy division.
Yeah.
So like where you are now, I guess, what have you learned in the process that's helped make things successful or sort of like, you know, what, because you were faking it till you made it.
Yeah.
Now you made it.
Yeah.
What have you sort of learned through this job about development and about like how to get things pushed through?
That's like interesting. I'm not sure. I mean, I definitely have learned a lot of like individual skills,
sure.
Like in terms of like getting an idea from paper to post-production. I think a lot of it is like clarity and simplicity. I don't think any comedic idea has benefited from being more complicated.
Sure.
Do you know what I mean?
Okay.
Like, there's like a lot of it's like, well, what if we just boil it down to its complete essence and kind of strip away a lot? And then that also leaves you open to notes from networks and you're flexible and able to take it into other directions. A lesson that I would like to apply more is like being more like firm and like stick to my guns when it comes to network stuff and notes. Because at a production company, you're like, you're selling and you will do anything for the buyer, you know, but you shouldn't. You should be able to like maintain your integrity and kind of keep the format the way you want it within reason and kind of be able to push back. But I feel like that is a really tough thing for someone who's younger, female, like it's just a weird power dynamic with networks, I think, to kind of like stick to your guns.
Yeah.
And be prepared to be like, well, then I don't want to make the show if that's the show.
Yeah.
That's a hard lesson that I have way not learned.
Yeah.
Even my boss will be like, well, fuck them. And then I'll hear him on a call and he'll be like, okay, great, great, great. Yeah, yeah, game show sounds great. And it's like, that, no.
Yeah.
It was never a game show.
I mean, it's also like it's hard to be in the business of sell. Like you're in a position where you are selling something to someone else into their brand,
yeah,
too. And so they're going to want input and pretty significant input in certain cases for like how it, you know what I mean? If it doesn't naturally align, they're going to want to have the flexibility to sort of like make it their own. Right?
Yeah, I think that's true. But then I think also like they bought this thing.
Yeah, that's true.
And they should want this thing. And they can say like, you know, this thing here or there, you know, you shouldn't be like, you know, completely like not flexible, but you know, you should be like, well, this is the thing. And if you want it, like, I heard how Search Party got made, which is like an awesome show.
Great show.
Oh my God. It was so good.
Yeah.
And I talked to the production company that made that, which is Jax Media. And they have the ability to film an entire pilot out of pocket. So they spent $500,000 and made the pilot and sold that pilot. And they were like, this is the show. This is the cast. Take it or leave it.
Yeah. I mean, that kind of goes back to what you were saying previously, which is rich people can do things
so nice.
That the rest of us can't.
$500,000.
Yeah. I mean, that sounds lovely.
Which is on the lower end of what a scripted pilot would be, like without a doubt.
So you guys don't just kick out $500,000 to pilot things that have no buyer?
Hey, baby, if I could, I would. I mean, that would be so dope.
Yeah.
I mean, some of these companies are just funded by complete, like, weird billionaires. And you're like, well, why don't you do more of that?
That, you know, that's what I really wish that there was more of that.
I know.
In this space. Because it feels like when you really think about it, like, you talk about our society, right? And there's this huge wealth concentration.
Mm-hmm.
What the fuck are they doing with that money?
Yeah.
Don't you wish there was more arts philanthropy happening from the 1% that was like, let's just make some weird shit that doesn't have to work, necessarily in any sort of commercial way. Let's just throw some money around.
I know. That's what Kanye wanted. He was like, I just need people to invest in me, to be creative and do my thing. He had to bring up the Medici family. Yeah. But that's what it used to be. They were just these, you know, rich families. I don't know. I always wonder, like, especially with, like, websites and stuff that start doing their own content. Yeah. I'm like, and now they're all pitching to networks. And I'm like, you guys could have beat the system.
Yeah.
Like, you could have done your own thing. And I don't know what it's like on a business standpoint, but fuck networks at a certain point. It's like, above average, just not be pitching. No, they should be doing their own thing. Like, Refinery 29, like, they could be doing their own thing. I don't, also, did not have a business degree. Don't know how you do these things, but I would have liked to have think that these places could have beat network stuff.
I think there was a point where it felt like that was possible. Mm-hmm. But honestly, I think that they figured out how to keep their stake, you know? Mm-hmm. And kind of what I've seen is like what happened with like YouTube as an example, right? It's like YouTube had this partner program that gave you some money.
Mm-hmm.
And they slowly figured out a way to like make your share of the pie less and less.
Mm-hmm.
And then Facebook comes along and goes, nope, now we're just going to not give you any money. You know what I mean? Like they've all figured, like all these places have figured out a way to keep the small, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
To keep the independent ventures. So now the ventures that do become successful look to sort of like sell themselves up in the chain. Like, you know what I mean? Like Refinery is part of a bigger corporate structure, right? Because that's what benefits them in the long term.
Yeah, like they are their own thing, but like they got a ton of money from Turner, like a lot of people did. So it's like they're expecting you know, to have pitches
to go into their
TBS,
system.
And that's the way it goes. And I don't know if they would have sustained otherwise, but I would like to think that the way it's going, it would be so much cooler.
It would be.
You know? And I'm sure, like, UCB has its own, you know, like, wrestling with that. It's like you have a brand, you have an audience. It would be awesome, but it's, I guess, too hard. Like, I'm doing a series with Maker Studios that should air in May, which is now, but so I don't know exactly when. but that was a tough – I mean, they were, you know, what is it, like a $1 billion investment by Disney?
Right.
And then, you know, that's tough.
Yeah.
That's, like, a hard thing to live up to.
Yeah, no, for
sure. And I think they had, like, all of these layoffs and stuff, so it's – it's hard.
Yeah, a lot of changes happening.
Yeah, and they're like, what about this as a theme park or like a theme park ride? Like, those are discussions
they're
having.
Those are the conversations happening at that point. Wow, that's wild.
Yeah, that's it's so depressing a little bit, too.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's hard. I feel like in development from a year ago to now, the climate, it seems different to me.
I mean, definitely.
Yeah.
And I think that Ben and I were just talking before this about the sort of half-life of ventures seem to be getting smaller and smaller. You know, that like the cycle for which some of these corporate entities are taking chances on things and figuring out how to make it work. It's like it happens quickly. A lot of it's about sort of like setting something up and then trading up to get out of it before the before the chips fall.
Yeah.
In a way, right?
Yeah, that's so true. But I guess, and who said this? I think I listen to Pete Holmes' podcast a lot, and I think he always says that Jim Gaffigan said, like, the only thing you have control of is to be undeniable.
Yeah.
And I think that on the artist's side, that's what you have to bank on. And whenever it happens, you have to just, like, and that, I think, goes back to, you know, pitching your own shows. It's like, what makes you super unique and what can be undeniable by you?
Yeah.
And you see that with our peers, too, of, like, people that are so, you know, they have this very specific point of view.
Yeah.
And they really kind of cut through everything else. And if a network isn't looking for that kind of show, they'll probably make concessions to get that person.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's, like, the most visible one right now in my brain is Tamanic, right?
Oh, my God.
What he's doing, which is like, there is something, like, there are so many Trump impressions in the world, and there is not a better reason for him to have a TV show than he is doing it better than everybody.
Yeah.
You know?
And also, but he did so many things better than everyone for so long, and it was just this perfect kind of
culmination
storm of terrible politics and time and you know, doing it for so long for free, and it was like, this is undeniable.
Yeah,
oh, that's so crazy.
So how does that knowledge or how does that experience and seeing that work on a development side inform your track as an actor? Because the other thing that is like that's out there in my brain is like, it sounds like you're having success on this side of Lisa.
Mm-hmm.
But you're not stopping doing the acting side.
Mm-mm.
And I imagine that that's where a little bit more of like the underlying who you are and passion sort of is as a mm-hmm. creative. So I'm wondering, how do you approach that side going yeah. forward too in this landscape with all the depressing shit we're talking about, but
I
also
know.
The sort of like knowledge you have and how to...
Yeah, that I mean, I wish I could be like, well, I have these tools, man, and I'm going to go into CISO,
yeah, sure.
and I'm going to get my show.
Yeah, maybe not this week in CISO.
Yikes. Every day the deadline articles come in and it is rough stuff for someone else. I mean, everyone can just feel better about, yeah. you know, it is bad for everyone and good for everyone at the same time.
Yeah,
yeah, I don't know. I mean, I had my own concept that I like took through to pilot. And it was tough. And like, I learned a lot from that experience and it being too close to a project and like having to be on calls where you're in there and your friends are there. It was really muddy and hard for me. And then when it got passed on, it's like you got passed on too. So I think what I'm taking from this as a performer is to do things that I genuinely love, and I'm not looking for the TV show. I'm just doing it for like the pure love of like performing and comedy. And like I'm like about to start, you know, I'm trying to like lock down like a good venue for just like a live show, which in all accounts like will lead to nothing. Like no one cares about another Brooklyn bar show, but I know that will make me happy and be like a good outlet for my creativity that can incubate somewhere else. And like my mod team has been like amazing this year, like
yeah.
and that has like really fulfilled me as a performer. And I'm not like pitching a new character, you know, show, you know, to all these networks based on it. I'm just trying to like keep myself super sharp and do things that I genuinely think are funny and collaborate with people because I know like that's what will like will lead to something greater.
Sure.
But I think if you end game, you're like, for lack of a better word, like super thirsty, and like the industry does not like want anyone thirsty. Like if you're like, this is my show and it's like a showcase, like there's nothing I hate more than like a comedy show that's like a veiled showcase.
Uh-huh.
So I think you just have to do things for you, and then that, and that's what you, so I'm balancing it, and I wish I could be like, oh, I'm packaging it, I've got a treatment for my show, and like it's gonna be a live show, but I'm gonna stream it on Facebook. Like I'm trying not to do that,
yeah.
and just do it for like the purity of it, and see where that lands.
That's interesting advice, because I don't think a lot of comedians think that way. I think people do think
mm-hmm.
that they need to make their one person show that
yeah.
character, you know,
yeah.
showcase for themselves rather than something that is distinctively excellent,
mm-hmm.
like on its own.
Yeah, it has to be excellent. Like, and if you want to do a one person show, and which we all have, like, absolutely do it, but just do it because you want to do it and not because, like, you're trying to cash in on some sort of, like, network need or phenomenon. Like, you're like, oh, I'm going to, this show should have Takeaway because Adam Ruins Everything is doing good. And that's like an info. Like, you can't think that way.
Mm-hmm.
You have to be one step ahead. And it goes back to that thing of, like, no one knows who you are. So you just have to do you.
Yeah.
And it could take a lot longer, but I don't know. I just that's how I think I need to go about things. But that being said, if you have a killer idea for a show, you do have to be professional, and you should write out your ideas and share it with friends
yeah.
and get feedback and be professional and packaged. But like, I don't know, that should come like when the idea is like really special.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah.
Did the, you know, I also think it's interesting that you were talking about having that sort of like buzzwordy packaging writing background.
Yeah.
Does that feel like because there is an element of like packaging materials for pitch that feel like they shouldn't have, like they're somewhere in the middle,
mm-hmm.
right? Because they're not like, you're not a lot of times writing full script as part of a presentation with a production company, right?
Yeah,
like,
mean,
unfunded full script going into a pitch, right?
Yeah, no one expects. I mean, well, I mean, we're working on like an animated show, and they have a sample episode script,
mm-hmm.
and then they also have like a, you know, beautiful deck that shows like the animation style. But like, how can you sell a scripted animated show
without that?
You know, and that's like that's not them playing the industry game. That's them being like,
mm-hmm.
this is what our vision of the show is. I think you have to be specific about what you want to make and how you want to make it, and whether that, and if the concept is clear enough in a log line that really sells it, that's totally fine. Like, I just take general pitches with people in the community, not in the community, of just like, and a lot of times we just talk about what they're interested in, and then sometimes something amazing will come up and it's like, I didn't know this about you. Like, I didn't know you had relatives here, or you always wanted to do this, and that can lead to a brainstorm. Yeah. So I think, like, if you have a scripted idea, you should write that script. If someone's like asking for a script and not paying you for it, then that's up to you. You know, like, is it, would you be doing it anyway? Then do it. But like, you know, don't do a ton of stuff for free. But like, if you have this great idea for a show, then having a script would help. But people have sold it on like a lot less than that. And usually a network will fund your pilot script. But I've talked to people that are like, I have it, I'm just not even sharing it with them yet. So they can be ready if they order it. And I think that's really smart.
Yeah, it's interesting. I've also heard more, like, in conversations I've been having recently, I've heard a couple of times about platforms that are like, we just go straight to series.
We don't
want pilot.
Platforms do that sometimes.
It's a waste of our time. We need to move faster than that. And I think that part of that comes back to the half. You're sort of like, we need to get going.
Mm-hmm.
If we're going to do it, it's got to be, one, a sure bet
for
us, and two, let's just do the whole fucking thing, because it's not worth it to spend a few months to, you know what I mean?
Yeah, I get that. I get that for like complexes like that, you know, I'm sure like Go 90, like all of those kind of like Verizon funded ventures.
Everything on Verizon,
which is a lot of weird
a
stuff.
A lot of stuff.
Who knew?
Yeah.
I have AT&T. They're not doing anything.
Well, they've got DirecTV, right?
Oh, I don't know.
That's their thing.
Okay, great.
But I don't think they do anything.
They're not doing any exclusive content. So yeah, they're not paying what other networks are paying for all this stuff, and they're you know, looking to get things like super speedy, so they don't get like, you know, beaten to the punch. So they're willing to go that way. But like, my bosses, I was like, oh, how cool would it be to go straight to series? Mike Kelton and I would be like, straight to Sear. Like, we would be like, that was like our goal.
Yeah.
And they were like, that is the first, like, that's a bad thing a lot of times, because you need that pilot to really figure out your idea and get it right. Mm. And a lot of times shows, and this is completely on traditional networks, I don't really think that Go 90 or all of those like streaming services have enough time to really see if these have longevity, because I think they're still figuring out how to actually make money. But like, for networks, it's like kind of like a death sentence.
Mm.
And I'm speaking just from like anecdotal stuff, but like, yeah, you could get that, like, you know, we'll do 8 episodes. It's like, you're not going to do more than that, because you didn't get a pilot. You didn't work it out. You didn't get the network notes. You haven't, like, sniffed each other out.
You think, like, it's just a matter of that?
I think it is. I think, like, a pilot is, like, I mean, it's just basically a proof of concept. So it's like, if you have this thing and then you have to make 8 of those things, you haven't even made one. I mean, 8 is even small, but, like, I think that's hard.
Yeah.
I think a perfect world is to get that, to get time. So it's like, we'll order 8, but we'll give that one a lot of attention.
Yeah.
But I don't, it's hard to do things that quickly.
That's interesting.
That's what I think.
I mean, it makes sense.
Yeah.
That definitely makes sense. It also feels like that so much of like development when it comes to like TV execution, though, is about presenting something that, like, the question is always like, what's episode 50?
Mm-hmm.
So there, it also does feel like, I don't know, it's like, it's an interesting thing where it's like, it does feel like you have to have the thought, on a creative side, you have to have the thought process of, how does this play, having never done anything with it before? There's not a piece of tape on this yet.
Yeah.
But I've got to have an answer for, what does episode 100 look like?
I know.
But then you're saying that even inside of that, once it gets messy and it gets made,
yeah,
shit changes, shit, you know what I mean? You figure stuff out.
You hire people that you shouldn't have hired.
Yeah.
You hired a showrunner that isn't as good as you thought they were going to be.
Mm-hmm.
And then the network, you know, someone, also this is a thing, like, people in networks just get fired all the time. So you could be stuck with someone else that wants something completely different.
Yeah.
I don't know. I think it is, development is like super slow and not a cool way, but there are certain things that I think make sense. And like, but I mean, I'm sure like like Anthony's show, like the President's show, like that is such an undeniable thing that you have to do right now that I don't know what their process was like, sure. But I can't imagine there was a lot of waiting.
Right.
And I think that's great.
I mean, there couldn't have been.
Yeah.
The guy was elected. How long ago?
And then it happened. But that's dope. Yeah. Like for Comedy Central, and they're awesome. Like their executives are so smart. Like they treat, I think, everything special and like unique to what it is. Right. But like, yeah, hit it.
And they market that shit.
Yeah.
Too. Like that, I think that show has a running chance because they are marketing the fuck out of it.
God, I hope so. It's so funny. I was reading that their ratings were really good for like the premiere, and I'm like, yeah, keep writing stuff like that because also critics need to relax, man. Like people like run things into the ground before they've had a chance to breathe, and that's so unfortunate.
Very true. Well, cool. Well, thanks for doing this.
Oh, really, yeah. This was awesome. I love talking about the biz.
Yeah. And enjoyed the Bronx Brewery?
Yeah. Yeah. Plug Bronx Brewery. Bronx Brewery, American Pale Ale.
American Pale Ale. Love this one.
6.3. That's pretty high.
It is. You know, actually, a lot of the Bronx beers have a high alcohol content.
Whoa.
Yeah. But they're very tasty. Very tasty and local.
I love it.
Well, thanks, Bronx. Thanks, Lisa, for doing it.
Thank you so much.
Okay, that'll do it for episode number 44 of the UCB Digital Podcast. Thanks to Lisa Kleinman for taking the time to sit down and chat. Hopefully it was beneficial to your work out there as well. If it was, we hope that you'll share this show with your friends. That's the best way to spread this show around. So we'd love it if you'd tweet it to a friend, email it to a friend, bring a hard copy on a CD over to a friend. We're not opposed to physical media here. If that's one of the lessons you take away from today, we love physical media. You can also give us a subscribe at iTunes.com/UCB Comedy. We'd appreciate that. You can also rate and review us there and find all sorts of other podcasts from the UCB Comedy Podcast Network. We'll be back next week with another episode of this show. We'll be drinking another beer from the Bronx Brewery, our official house beer of the UCB Comedy Podcast Network. Visit thebronxbrewery.com for information on all their craft beers and pick one up the next time that you're out and about in New York City. UCB Comedy's got new videos up on YouTube and Vimeo. We got some great ones. We got new videos coming out in our Drawings Man Presents series on YouTube. Those are releasing the whole month of May. They are weird, they are wild, and they are very funny. YouTube/UCB Comedy. Our new short, The Second Mrs. Pell, is up on Vimeo.com/UCB Comedy. We love Vimeo. We love that community. And this short is a really wonderful addition to that and to our page. Check it out. We hope you will. Follow UCB Comedy all over the social medias at UCB Comedy. And follow us, the digital podcast, at UCB Digital. And until next time, y'all, we'll see you on the internet.
This has been a UCB Comedy production. Check out our other shows on the UCB Comedy Podcast Network.